Today is Monday, December 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. New restrictions against the coronavirus are in place across the European Union.
UK Health Minister Matt Hancock says the new variant of the coronavirus is not to be taken lightly.
Plus, what are the larger implications of the U.S. government computer hack?
And it could be just really, really consequential in terms of the amount of data.
And an African music legend retires with one last project. We'll have these stories and more next. One by one, several European Union nations have banned flights from the United Kingdom in an effort to block a new strain of coronavirus currently sweeping across southern England. AP correspondent Karen Chamas starts us off.
Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, Austria and Italy all announced restrictions on UK travel. The Netherlands banned flights from the UK for at least the rest of the year, while Belgium issued a flight ban for 24 hours starting at midnight and also halted train links to Britain, including the Eurostar. Austria and Italy said they would halt flights from the UK, but did not say exactly when that would take place. UK Health Minister Matt Hancock says the new variant of the coronavirus is not to be taken lightly.
The cases in the Tier 4 areas, as you've seen from the graphs that have been presented, have absolutely rocketed in the last few days, last 2 weeks or so.
Karen Chamas, London.
British scientists are scrambling to work out whether the mutant strain of the coronavirus may be resistant to the crop of newly developed vaccines. The strain was first identified on December 13th in the county of Kent in southern England, and initial analysis by government scientists suggests it is growing faster than the existing variants. Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center said on Sunday that there are 76.3 million global COVID-19 cases. The United States continues to lead the world in cases at 17.6 million, followed by India with 10 million and Brazil with 7.2. South Korea recorded 1,097 new infections Sunday, the fifth consecutive day it recorded more than 1,000 new cases. Starting Monday, the Australian states of Victoria and Queensland are banning people arriving from Sydney, where a 70-person coronavirus cluster has emerged in its northern beach suburbs. The areas have now been placed under a strict lockdown until Christmas Eve. Thailand said on Sunday that it's going to test more than 10,000 people in the southwestern province of Samosakon after a daily surge of more than 500 cases. In the United States, the initial shipments of the second COVID-19 vaccine authorized by the U.S. have left a factory as the nation works to bring the coronavirus pandemic under control. In the western state of California, hospitals are battling to find beds for patients amid fears that the exploding coronavirus infection rate will exhaust resources and healthcare workers. As of Saturday, nearly 17,400 people were hospitalized with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 infections, more than double the previous peak reached in July. More than 3,600 confirmed or suspected COVID-19 patients are in intensive care units. Just 2% of the beds are left as of Saturday, with the death rate spiraling even higher. The World Health Organization's vaccine chief, Dr. Catherine O'Brien, says every country should have access to COVID-19 vaccines as early as feasible. But she warns that the call for global solidarity has mostly been lost as richer nations buy out vaccine stocks. Now there are fears that desperate poor countries could be shut out of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. Health officials say that they could then turn to scientifically unproven alternatives as they face a second wave of the pandemic. VOA's Chinedu Afor spoke with Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, in New York, about the concerns of her group.
Wealthy countries like the European Union bloc, the UK, the United States of America, Canada, they certainly have invested a tremendous sum. I don't want to disregard the tens of billions of dollars that governments, including my own, the government of the United States, I think about $12 billion into Operation Warp Speed and into the development of financing research and development, financing what we call at-risk manufacturing scale-up. So basically paying pharmaceutical companies to start developing manufacturing capacity before they even have approved vaccines, and then also engaging in contracts to secure you know, tens of millions of doses in advance. They have paid from the public's purse. It is our taxpayer dollars that have paid for this. There are some vaccines like Moderna's vaccine where almost 100% of the research and development has been financed by the public purse. And certainly governments need to get something in return. But what they're getting in return right now is handsome returns in terms of securing doses for their domestic populations, but they're not doing it in a globally minded way. And I think the most important thing is every American citizen, for example, every European citizen should understand that they're truly not safe until everybody in the world is safe. These vaccines are going to be a tremendous help to our public health package of combating COVID-19, for sure. But they're not the panacea. They need to be used in tandem with other public health measures. And everybody around the world who is most vulnerable needs to be protected if anybody is going to be protected. A person sitting here in Brooklyn, where I'm sitting, is vulnerable to coronavirus if somebody in a country in South Sudan, in Niger, is vulnerable, because we are just an interconnected world. You can't isolate yourself. So I hope that citizens of these countries, which are going to benefit from this tremendous public investment, I hope they have that awareness.
Are there fears that some people in these poorer countries, if they are able to get access to COVID vaccines, might turn to some unscientifically unproven cure, making the matter worse?
We're globally connected. People read the news. People in countries which right now are truly at the back of the line and likely won't see COVID-19 vaccines for months, if not possibly years, they're reading what's happening in the news. They're reading that people in the United States are getting these vaccines right now. People in the UK are getting these vaccines. And they're likely frustrated because it's not that they're immune, no pun intended, from coronavirus there. I don't know what people will resort to if they feel like they, you know, don't get access to the leading medical tools. I hope that people use their wherewithal to be able to assess what's truly, you know, a medical intervention and what is an unfounded remedy. I wouldn't want to dismiss people and say that they'll sort of take these unscientifically substantiated measures. I think that's what those people want is they want access to the medical tools that everybody around the world should have. They want access to the medical tools that shouldn't just be a luxury of people sitting in wealthy countries. And I hope that with global collaboration, I hope that with global solidarity, that organizations here in the United States that are fighting for access for people in other countries, organizations in the UK and EU that are fighting for access for people in poorer countries, will work collaboratively with people in those countries so that we can, you know, achieve this together.
Kate Elder is the Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking to my colleague Chinedu Afor. U.S. President Donald Trump is downplaying the severity of a massive cybersecurity breach by suspected Russian operatives. Break-in has exposed the networks of government agencies and private sector companies, contradicting the assertions of a Secretary of State and lawmakers briefed on the matter. Among those impacted are at least 18,000 customers of the Texas-based Solar Winds Company, including the Departments of Energy, Treasury, and Commerce, as well as state and local governments. After days of silence, Trump took to Twitter on Saturday for the first comments about the hack. But unlike intelligence officials and lawmakers who warn damage from the breach is ongoing, the president says, quote, everything is well under control, end quote. He also said that China may be involved. Russia denies that it is behind the breach. Augusta University cybersecurity professor John Heslin discusses the larger impact of the attack.
One of the first computer intrusion, you know, if we're assuming this was the Russians, by the Russians, actually occurred in a, believe it or not, a mainframe computer back in 1968. And then there were two major incidents in the 90s, one known as Solar Sunrise, that actually ended up not being Russians. It was a couple of kids in California who had teamed up with kind of a well-known Israeli hacker. And then, but the big one in the 90s was one that's called, what's called Moonlight Maze. And that's where Russian entities that are believed to have been associated with the Russian government were intruding into various university and military computer systems, looking for basically, high-tech research that the military was conducting. It's believed it went on for more than a year before it was shut down. So when I look at these things, I look at them in terms of historical context, and you know, this is surely not the first one, and it's definitely not the last one. I mean, it could be just really, really consequential in terms of the amount of data that was lost. And so, yeah, I mean, it's sort of early to know, but my feeling is this is going to be, fairly significant.
One of the discussions taking place in the computer arena is that because the infiltrators had been in the system for so long and are currently thought to be there now while the cleanup is taking place, how do you go on from here to secure your network, not knowing the scope of the infiltration to protect the data that hasn't been retrieved yet?
The problem is with that sort of long-term access, and we've seen this before, even with the Moonlight Maze hack that I mentioned back in the 90s, when people have this sort of long-term access to systems and they know what they're doing, they can sort of burrow in other parts of the network and into files and things like that. They're very clever about that. So if they just sort of stay put and don't move around for a while, they can sort of have later access. So the trick is, and believe me, it's a tall order, is for these companies to then that know they have been hacked to sort of go in and figure out to what extent the hackers have sort of burrowed into their system to sort of exploit it later on. And that's really a tall order. I don't think there's other sort of methods, automatic methods to sort of catch these types of intruders moving around, but it's not fail safe. And when you have somebody as good and sort of technically competent as the Russians are, I guess I would say stay tuned, but it's definitely a tall order to figure this out.
Is there a way for companies to be fairly certain that incoming software as part of a patch is safe and secure?
I don't think there is a way, at least right now, that exists to be 100% secure. I mean, when you sort of are able to dupe a world-class company like FireEye with this sort of supply chain attack, I mean, if you can get in FireEye systems, you can probably get in anybody's systems. So the discussion now, and it's been going on for many years. I think this vulnerability's obviously been identified for a long time, but it's just really, really, really difficult nut to crack. And I'm not exactly sure technically how you prevent it from happening in the future.
John Haslin is a cybersecurity professor at Augusta University in the southeastern state of Georgia. A car bomb attack in Kabul has resulted in several fatalities in Afghanistan, and Reuters reporter David Doyle brings us this update.
A car bomb targeting an Afghan lawmaker killed at least 9 people in Kabul on Sunday, officials said. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the blast, which lawmaker Khan Mohammad Wardak was reported to have survived. But it comes amid a sharp rise in violence in recent weeks as the Afghan government and Taliban hold talks to find an end to the country's almost 20-year-long war. Interior Minister Masoud Andarabi said Wardak had survived the blast, but was among 20, including women and children, who were injured. It's unclear if the bomb was in a vehicle parked along the lawmaker's route or driven by the bomber. Separate bombings were also reported on Sunday in several other provinces, in which civilians and members of the security forces were killed. On Friday, a suspected rickshaw bomb killed at least 15 civilians, including 11 children, in the central Ghazni province.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle. And coming up later,
a mashup combines a variety of songs from different genres to create one single new musical work. So Nama Dingo and his team traveled to Chalamanda's home in Chiradzulu District, southern Malawi, to record this mashup. It combines Chalamanda's most popular hits from the 1970s and the 1980s over one easygoing reggae beat.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. It's known that Earth's only natural satellite is the Moon. There have also been a number of objects, usually asteroids, that have fallen under the influence of Earth's gravity to become what some call secondary moons. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says a tiny new secondary moon of Earth was discovered in mid-September by the Pan-STARRS 1 survey telescope in Hawaii. The Minor Planet Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, designated the object as 2020 SO. What makes this secondary moon so unique is that it's not an asteroid or a natural object, but is actually the booster stage of a rocket that helped send the Surveyor 2 lander to the moon in 1966. JPL says it will only be a temporary satellite and will return to a solar orbit after a few months. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ethiopian refugees are evacuating border camps in Sudan as aid has been diverted to Rakuba, the country's main camp, where many still lack food and shelter. But refugees say the camp, far from the border, may be safer after the Sudanese army reported a cross-border raid on Tuesday. VOA's Heather Murdoch is in Sudan.
In the past week, hundreds of families have been bused from camps near the Ethiopian border here to the Rakuba camp, deeper inside Sudan, where most of the roughly 50,000 new Ethiopian refugees are now staying. A week ago, refugees were being told to come here for food and shelter. In recent days, the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region seems to be closer to the border than before, and refugees say moving farther into Sudan has become more urgent. Many here arrived late Thursday from the Hashaba camp, not far from the border with Ethiopia. Hagu Kadani is a farmer who fled Ethiopia over a month ago. He says from Hashaba camp, he could increasingly hear bombing from across the border. Like many refugees who arrived in the past week, Kadani has no place to sleep and is waiting to register for other necessities. The camp has quickly become crowded, and families are making shelters out of found items and their clothes. When they fled their homes a little over a month ago, many people witnessed beatings, looting, and killings on the street. Some small children say they remember running past dead bodies as they fled. Phone and internet service is still blacked out in much of the region, so many of the war's details remain unknown. People who have been able to talk to their families inside the war zone say they are told it is no safer now than it was when they fled. Gabaraha is a 40-year-old mother and grandmother. She says if she returns to Ethiopia, she is certain she will be killed. So she has no choice but to wait out the war here in Sudan. A statement posted on the Sudanese army's Facebook page says soldiers were killed and property was destroyed in the recent cross-border attack, but it does not include further details. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Rakuba Camp, Sudan.
Sudan's prime minister has met with his Ethiopian counterpart. Sunday's meeting came as Sudanese troops advanced to reclaim border territories controlled by Ethiopian militias. Abdullah Hamdok's office said the meeting with Abiy Ahmed took place on the sidelines of a regional summit in Djibouti. UN agencies are rushing emergency aid to thousands of victims of Cyclone Gati, the most powerful tropical storm ever to hit Somalia. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Somalia has experienced 15 tropical storms, cyclones, and flash floods over the past 3.5 decades, but has never seen anything like Cyclone Gati. The storm made landfall in Puntland's Bari region November 22nd, dumping around 2 years of rainfall in just a few days. The United Nations says the cyclone has caused widespread destruction to schools, health facilities, and other infrastructure, killed thousands of livestock, and destroyed livelihoods. UN High Commissioner for Refugee spokesman Baba Baluch says more than 180,000 people's lives have been upended by Gati, including 42,000 displaced from their homes.
Cyclone Gati is resulting in a humanitarian emergency on top of existing emergencies in a country grappling with conflict, the coronavirus pandemic, and desert locusts, making this an exceptionally difficult year for those displaced in Somalia.
The UNHCR is planning to assist 36,000 cyclone victims in the hard-hit Bari region. They include internally displaced people, refugees, and members of local host communities. The agency, together with the World Food Program and other humanitarian organizations, recently airlifted relief supplies from Mogadishu to the city of Bosaso in the Bari region. The consignment includes essential non-food items such as mosquito nets, jerry cans, soap, blankets, sleeping mats, and plastic sheets. Baluch says the UNHCR also will provide cash for emergency shelter to some of the victims.
The world's vulnerable face some of the worst effects of climate change, including food, water, and land insecurity, and disrupted services necessary for human health, livelihood, settlement, and survival. Invariably, among the most affected are older people, women, children, and people with disabilities.
Baluch says Cyclone Gati has separated families, destroyed livelihoods, and increased the risk of gender-based violence. He says many of the displaced are returning to their damaged or destroyed homes, but that rebuilding their lives will be difficult. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Around 100 people have been detained in the Belarusian capital during anti-government protests that were prompted by the re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko on August 9th. Demonstrators marched down residential areas of Minsk on Sunday and demanded the resignation of Lukashenko and protested his government's violent crackdown on activists and demonstrators. Britain insisted Sunday that the European Union should budge to open the way to a new post-Brexit trade pact, drawing a swift response from the bloc's negotiator defending the union's right to protect its interests. The transition period to secure a deal ends December 31st. VOA Music Time in Africa host Heather Maxwell has this look at how a retiring music legend is going out with one last big bang.
Geddes Chalamanda is the oldest living legend in Malawian music today. But his music risks being forgotten. At least that's the belief that inspired Patience Mamadingo, one of Malawi's hottest superstars today, to do a mashup with him in duet. The recording is a huge success, but it also triggered Chalamanda's retirement from music. Here's what happened. Mamadingo took the country by storm in 2020 with his reggae mashup idea. He recorded a series of duet mashups with top name artists all across the country. He chose to feature Chalamanda because he wanted to re-engage him and his music in the hearts and the minds and the ears of today's youthful listeners. Now, a mashup combines a variety of songs from different genres to create one single new musical work. So Mamadingo and his team traveled to Chalamanda's home in Chiradzulu District, southern Malawi, to record this mashup. It combines Chalamanda's most popular hits from the 1970s and the 1980s over one easygoing reggae beat. The whole thing is 8 minutes long, but I'll just give you some highlights here. It opens with Line, Line Hu, and that is a song from a father's perspective who sings about how wonderful his daughter is. She's hardworking, she obeys the family, she does things for them, and she is just absolutely the bravest of all. Then you hear one of Chalamanda's songs about his father, and this one is about his father who in real life left the family when he was a boy and never came back. Chalamanda had been wondering for years, and he sings in the song, I wonder if my dad's coming back, I wonder where he is. And then at some point he says to Mamadingo, wait a minute, I actually know now that my father is dead because I'm 90. And then we hear Napolo, another hit tune, a true old story about a terrible flood that killed a district commissioner. It swept him away in his car and carried him off into the lake where he drowned. And then there's Buffalo Soldier, probably Chalamanda's biggest hit of all. The whole song is anchored around his refrain, I want to go to America. I dream about going to America. If I only had enough money, I would go see America. So that sums up the music video. It's 8 minutes long, so you can get on YouTube and watch the whole thing if you want to. But a couple notes. One, Chalamanda did end up going to America. His dream came true in 2016, 40 years about after the release of that song.
The fellows are gone.
He performed at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and other areas in the Atlantic East Coast. And finally, his retirement. How did Chalamanda end up retiring right after he recorded this successful mashup duet with Nama Dingo? Here's how. Nama Dingo is also a humanitarian and a brand ambassador for FDH Bank. He convinced Chalamanda to retire with the promise of a gift from the bank for a grocery store, the only one in his town, worth 2 million kwacha. Well, we wish him a happy retirement and also look forward to hearing his new songs in new versions by new artists in Malawi and, who knows, maybe around the world.
Heather Maxwell is the host of VOA's Music Time in Africa. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe. And have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is leading the U.S. response to back-to-back hurricanes in Central America. USAID's Disaster Assistance Response Team is working alongside the U.S. military to help victims after the devastating storms. Hurricanes Eta and Iota hit the region November 3rd and 16th, killing a reported total of 189 people and affecting more than 6 million in Colombia, Panama, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Honduras. Allison Lapp is a response manager for Latin America and Caribbean Hurricane Response Management Team at USAID.
In some places, the flooding was neck high or even higher. And so as a result, tens of thousands of people needed to flee their homes and go to collective evacuation centers.
Those evacuation centers are where USAID's team is focusing on immediate life-saving activities, including the provision of food and clean drinking water, as well as other basic needs.
USAID has been providing, for example, mattresses, blankets, hygiene kits in those shelters to make life there more manageable. We have also funded the installation of sanitation facilities and showers to help, again, meet the basic needs of these people.
The United States government has allocated nearly $48 million to assist vulnerable populations affected by hurricanes in Latin America. In support of USAID's response, the U.S. military delivered 1.2 million pounds of food, water, and other critical relief supplies to the hard-to-reach areas that needed it most. Funds from existing COVID-19 response programs are being used to help prevent the spread of disease in evacuation facilities. All of this builds on years of USAID efforts to strengthen local disaster response capacity, enhance early warning systems, teach disaster preparedness to primary school children, develop community action plans, and train first responders. In the longer term, the current aid will also lay the groundwork for people to return to their communities and help start early recovery efforts.
The programs that we put in place will continue for up to 12 months. From there, we turn over to our USAID development colleagues in the missions in each of these countries who will work on reconstruction and then back to longer-term development in support of these countries.
This is just the generosity of the American people on display, said Lapp. From the hearts of the American people, straight to those who are most affected by disasters.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.